I've just put a little map up here, which I grabbed from work the other day. Just so people have a vague idea, this is the Indigenous Nations of Australia, and the Gurindji that we're talking about are up here in the Northern Territory. The little dot that's over here in the Mudborough place is actually the centre of the Wave Hill cattle station, which is what our story is going to be about today. And obviously the talk's about the Gurindji people, and I do just want to acknowledge quickly that Melbourne is on Wurundjeri land, which is a different Indigenous nation, and, you know, like all the Aboriginal nations, they never ceded their sovereignty. So, you know, we're very lucky to be here today and hopefully be doing something very small in our own way to actually go some way towards righting the wrongs of the past. But I was actually going to start with a song. This is the first song I've ever learned on guitar, so we'll see how it goes. But Phil might know the song. It's a great little song about the Gurindji strike. I didn't actually know it was about the Gurindji strike. I just knew the chorus. So if you know the chorus, please feel free to join in. And I might have to refer to the words every now and then. So it's by Paul Kelly, and it's called From Little Things, Big Things Grow. And Kev Carney, sorry. Gather round, people, let me tell you a story, an age-long story of power and pride. British Lord Vesey and Vincent Lingyari were opposite men on opposite sides. Vesey was fat with money and muscle, beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean and he spoke very little, he had no bank balance, hard dirt was his floor. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Gurindji were working for nothing but rations, where once they had gathered the wealth of the land. Daily the pressure got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand. They picked up their swags and started off walking. At Wadi Creek, they sat themselves down. Now it don't sound like much, but it sure got tongues talking. Back at the homestead and then in the town. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Vesey man said, I'll double your wages, 18 quid a week you'll have in your hands. Vincent said, we're not talking about wages, we're sitting right here till we get our land. Vesey man roared and Vesey man thundered, you don't stand the chance of a cinder in snow. Vince said, if we fall, others are rising. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Then Vincent Lingyari boarded an aeroplane, landed in Sydney, big city of lights. And daily he went round, softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life. And Vincent sat down with big politicians. This affair, they told him, is a matter of state. Let us sort it out. Your people are hungry. Vincent said, no thanks, we know how to wait. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Then Vincent Lingyari returned in an aeroplane back to his country once more to sit down. And he told his people, let the stars keep on turning. We have friends in the south, in the cities and towns. 8 years went by,
8 long years of waiting till one day a tall stranger appeared in the land. And he came with lawyers, and he came with great ceremony, and through Vince's fingers poured a handful of sand. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. That was the story of Vincent Lignari, but this is the story of something much more. How power and privilege cannot move a people when they know where they stand and stand in the law. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
That was a bit of fun. Excellent. So, on the 23rd of August last year, 2006, it was actually 40 years since the Gurindji people walked off the Best Use Cattle Station at Wakehill. And they celebrate that day as Freedom Day every year, but last year was a really big celebration. And a small Melbourne press called One Day Hill actually republished the book that we're talking about today, which is The Unlucky Australians by Frank Hardy, which is a classic book, and I wasn't even aware it had been out of print for a very long time. And Paul Kelly actually writes on the back of the book, talking about this song that I've just sung, quote, "I'd heard of the Gurindji Wakehill walk-off story in my travels over the years. Kev Carmody and I went on a camping trip to Queensland and came up with the melody and an idea. Then I read Frank's book, which put me right there, and the rest of the song came in a rush after that." I just want to read a little bit as well from the foreword of the book, which is by Hardy's children, surviving children Alan Hardy and Shirley Hardy Ricks. And they say that the day Gough Whitlam poured the red soil of Gurindji country into Vincent Lignari's hand was a momentous day in the history of land rights in this country. It was also one of the proudest moments in our father's life. To help this remarkable group of people win back their own land was one of his greatest achievements. The Gurindji took on the might of Lord Vestey and the Australian government. They were dogged in their determination to live on the land of their dreaming, their traditional land. Their story is an important part of Australia's history. It's a story that was played out years before Eddie Mabo began his fight for recognition of the traditional owners of this country. Almost 10 years after the Gurindji walked away from Wakehill, their battle was won. The town of Dangaroo was built on the banks of Wadi Creek. The Gurindji finally had a home. And many of you might know a bit about Frank Hardy, but I know when I got involved in the left, I knew bugger all about him, apart from his name seemed to pop up in a lot of books in second-hand shops. So I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to research this talk and read a few of his books and some of what others have written about him, because having done so, it really seems to me that Frank Hardy was probably the most famous Australian radical of the 20th century. He was born into an Irish family in Bathurst Marsh in 1917, an auspicious year for a communist, the year of the Russian Revolution. He was a novelist, a playwright, a storyteller, a self-styled larrikin, really, an active member of the Communist Party from the 30s until the 60s, and a staunch leftist until his death in 1994. And I think his three most significant contributions are the books Power Without Glory, The Unlucky Australians, and another one called But the Dead Are Many. And I don't really have time to talk much about them, but who might know that Power Without Glory was a novel conceived by Hardy and other members of the Communist Party as part of the struggle against right-wing, anti-communist influence in the trade union movement. It was published in 1950, and Hardy achieved a national profile when the Crown case against him for criminal libel, of which he was in the end acquitted, coincided with the Menzies government's attempt to ban the Communist Party in the referendum of 1991, which was also narrowly defeated. And quickly, But the Dead Are Many, which I've just read, was published 25 years later, and I think it tells us something important about Hardy. It was published in 1975, and it draws on the suicide of his friend, the communist intellectual Paul Mortier. And Hardy's aim is to explore the effects of Stalinism on the communist movement, and in particular, the loss of faith in the communist movement, the effect of that on the psychology of an individual who has dedicated his entire life to the cause. And although some of the conclusions of the book do show Hardy drifting away from Marxism, But the Dead Are Many is still an excellent attempt, I think, to carve out a radical space, a space for radical politics in the post-Stalinist era, and I would recommend reading that if you can. You can probably get it for a couple of bucks pretty easily. But on to The Unlucky Australians, which was published in 1968. And the title might seem fairly obvious what it refers to, but it's actually quite specific. It refers to Donald Horne's 1965 book, The Lucky Country, in a particular famous comment where Horne wrote that Australia is a lucky country run by second-rate people who share its luck. And Horne considered Australia to be lucky because its wealth derived mainly from its immense reserves of natural resources rather than the intelligent managing of these resources and its human resources. And obviously this is a conservative criticism from a capitalist standpoint. And more radically, I think, Hardy's title, The Unlucky Australians, suggests that the luck of Australian capitalists that Horne is talking about is precisely the bad luck of the Aboriginal people. And when I'm referring back to the book, I'm going to be using more the term Aboriginal and talking about today more the term Indigenous. Big pastoralists and mining companies in this country grew rich exploiting, transforming, even destroying the land which Aboriginal people once inhabited in a sustainable fashion. Big cattle stations in particular were especially lucky to have Aboriginal labour which knew the land, knew how to survive in it, and could be employed for next to nothing. And as an indicator of the Australian society that we're talking about, it's worth recalling that when Frank Packer, Kerry's dad, made Donald Horne the editor of the magazine The Bulletin in 1961, it was Horne who was the first editor who actually removed the famous masthead from the front of the bulletin which said Australia for the white man. So this is in 1961, remember. Now, The Unlucky Australians begins in 1966. Hardy's hitchhiking his way up to Darwin from Sydney. He's heading north in search of something. He's not quite sure what, partly inspiration, partly some peace and quiet to finish his latest novel and do some new writing. He's going up to stay with a film director friend of his, Cecil Holmes, who was recently acclaimed at the time. And it seems like a strange beginning at the start of the book. We get all these, this little collection of reminiscences, Hardy's time in the army during the Second World War up at Mataranka, when he led a sort of strike of soldiers and ended up recruiting a whole lot of them to the Communist Party. We get ruminations on Henry Lawson and Banjo Patterson as he goes through rural New South Wales. Tales of the TAB. Hardy was absolutely incorrigible gambler who ended up writing horse racing columns in the 1970s and 80s. And signs of racism are everywhere, however, even at the start of the book, particularly in the segregation of the pubs in Bourke and Mount Isa. And to Hardy, the pub is this symbol of an Australian egalitarianism which is not even skin deep. You know, any stranger can be a mate, and if it's your turn, you'd better head to the bar. But Aboriginal people are just excluded. There's no way in for them. And even in the Bullring, a Darwin pub where the only whites are nigger lovers and gin jockeys, as one racist tells Hardy, two Aborigines are arrested for no apparent reason. They're not even drunk. And one punter suggests to Hardy, maybe the police just have a quota, they've got to arrest a few Aboriginals every night. And talking at the pub, it's his friend Holmes who introduces Hardy to the plight of the Northern Territory's Aboriginal stockmen and their communities. They're fed on nothing but salt beef and bread. They're living in tin humpies. The women are routinely exploited and assaulted. Social service money goes direct to station management. Wages are £2.8 shilling a week, but it's often paid in credit at the company's store where the prices are hugely inflated. Sometimes the wages aren't paid for months on end, if at all. And not much is actually discussed in the book about the recent, then recent history of the embryonic Aboriginal rights movement, but there's a few important things to say, I think, for the background. And the first one is that as with the war and with technological development, it actually kind of ended the isolation of Northern Australia to some degree. Aboriginal workers ended up taking on many of the jobs that had been vacated by whites who enlisted in the army, similar to how women entered the workforce en masse in the first time. Wartime construction also brought black labour and white labour together to an unprecedented degree. And just after the war, in 1946, came the first famous strike, the Pilbara strike in Western Australia, which actually had 20 out of the 22 cattle stations there completely out on strike. In the late 40s, wages were finally introduced for Aboriginal stockmen. There were strikes in the early 50s, which provoked the largest white protests yet seen in solidarity with black workers, and they were led by communists in the Northern Australian Workers' Union, or the NAWU, which we'll be talking about a bit. In the 50s, there was the creation of the Federal Council for the Advancement of Aborigines, whose title was later amended to include Torres Strait Islanders, and the SCAA lobbied the trade union conferences, the ACCU, in 1959, 61 and 63. And eventually in 1963, the ACCU adopted a policy officially calling for an end to discrimination against Aboriginal labour. In 1965, just before our book begins, the NAWU, the Northern Australian Workers Union, presented a successful application to the Arbitration Commission seeking award wages for Aborigines, and this is an important moment. However, acting for the pastoralists was one John Kerr, who was later an infamous Governor-General and at that time was a pretty much equally infamous Conservative lawyer. And Kerr convinced the commissioners that they should accept a slow worker clause which would actually negate the award ruling at the employer's discretion, and also to postpone the implementation of the award system until 1968. So Hardy's just heard about this latest development of the granting of the award, but its postponement until 1968, when Holmes mentions the current strike at Newcastle Waters cattle station, which is further south than the Green Gin Lab. And this has been running for 8 weeks after Stockman were called out on the 1st of May, again an auspicious day, by Dexter Daniels, the NAWU's Aboriginal organiser. And it's from this point on that Hardy's drawn into the struggle. And it's funny, in the book he presents it as it's almost against his better judgment. You know, he just wants to go up to Darwin for a bit of peace and quiet and have a, you know, write a few nice stories and save a bit of money up for his family back down south. I'm not really convinced of that. I think he's probably using that as a bit of a stylistic device to persuade a potentially neutral or even hostile readership to actually go along with the story and enter into it with him. Because what Hardy is great at, thank you, is providing the reader with a really clear window on his mind. He knows that for most of white Australia, particularly at that time in the 60s, this so-called Aboriginal problem is just too far away, it's too difficult to solve. And with this book, his aim is to really take us there, not just in a standard history sense where it's this happened and then that happened and here was this person you never met and here was this person, but actually take us there and, you know, help us to feel the emotions he feels and meet the people that he meets. And the best way that he does this is through transcribing a whole series of tape recordings of interviews that he actually records when he's there. And so we get to read the story as he hears them and as the storytellers themselves actually intend them to be heard with their own emphases and so on. And that's especially important because most of the main characters in the book are Aboriginal people who've never learned to read and write. Anyway, the effect is amplified, especially by Hardy's refusal to alter their accounts in any way, correcting spelling and grammar, nothing like that. The words are transcribed phonetically. I'm going to read a few of them out a little bit later on. So in all this, I think, you know, in writing a book where it starts off, he doesn't even know that he's writing a book. And by actually eschewing objectivity and saying, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing up there. But then also by allowing multiple voices into the book, I think The Unlucky Australians is an important work which stands in the tradition of reportage, which was pioneered by the Czech communist writer Egon Kish, and then also at the same time influenced by other, developments in the 1960s, like the new journalism in America, people like Tom Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson, adopted by writers like Mailer and Capote. So when we're there, when Hardy's up in Darwin, he's just thinking, oh, I'm going to put my toe into this struggle, maybe get a bit involved, and he receives a visit from this Dexter Daniels, who's the guy who led the Newcastle Water Stockmen out on strike. And Daniels has gone on leave from the union, actually. He's frustrated by the obstacles that the right-wing leadership of the union are putting in his way. And Daniels is sizing Hardy up. He's asking his opinion of the courts, the ACTU, and then whether he thinks that there should be more strikes of Aboriginal stockmen. Daniel says there are workers everywhere, all across the Northern Territory, just waiting for him to come and they'll go out on strike. Daniels looks Hardy in the eye and he says, I read in the paper you write books about them rich fellas. You know how to fight? And I want to quote Hardy's response just to give you a flavour, and I think it's a really important passage. Hardy writes, it was my turn to hesitate. Could I encourage this young Aborigine to lead his people to defy the pastoralists and the arbitration court and the federal government and the ACTU and the NAWU? I began to count the cost. Aborigines huddled in strikers' camps while white men sought solutions behind closed doors. The ACTU seeking formulas. The pastoralists seeking revenge in remote places where their power is limitless. The court ruling the strikes illegal. Non-unionists on strike without union support. The problem of raising funds and feeding strikers spread over such a vast area. And me involved in it, drawn once more into the turmoil of political struggle, away from the serenity the writer needs. Perhaps, after all, the NAWU and the ACTU were right. Wait till 1968, and meanwhile confer to obtain gradual upgrading of Aboriginal stockmen's wages. Suddenly, in a flash of insight, I could see the heart of my dilemma. The mainspring of my life had been compassion, the feeling for the underdog. The poor shall feed the birds, the poor shall help the poor. The indelible imprint of the hungry 30s, the idealism, and here he's talking about communism, the just cause which showed itself in turn for power to be unjust. The stairway to the stars had been kicked away from me. The conviction that leads a man to feel injustice, to fight injustice, to stand beside the dispossessed, the lowly, the scum of the earth, had faded when the poor were no longer with us. People might want to talk about this. Apathetic in their affluence, sitting in front of the idiot box watching Don Lane, the World Championship Wrestling, and the Munsters. The conviction could have survived the affluent apathy, but Stalin killed, as well as his direct victims, the idealism of millions. There was a time when I would intervene if a shopping mother slapped her tired child in the street. Now I could turn my back on the horror of Vietnam because white Australia disgusted me with its complacency, its racism, its philistinism. White Australia could go to hell by its own road, but white Australia's greatest crime was its debasement of the Aborigines. Those near them didn't care. Those far from them didn't want to know. Well, let white Australia beware. The Northern Territory Aborigines were ready to stand and be counted, and I would stand and be counted with them. That's pretty dramatic there at the end. But I'll give you a sense of where Hardy's at when he's up in Darwin. And really, though, the rest of the book does show Hardy pretty much living up to that promise that he makes. He helps to initiate the refoundation of the Northern Territory Council for Aboriginal Rights, then a joint committee between this council and a very cautious NAWU, which is designed to coordinate support if any more strikes break out. He's at the same time encouraging Dexter Daniels and other Aboriginal leaders to do precisely that, to lead other workers out on strike. So when Daniels meets up with Vincent Lingyari, who you remember from our song, and this is rather fortuitous because the Gurindji elder is actually in Darwin having his broken foot healed, Daniels encourages him to lead the Gurindji stockmen off at Wakehill, a huge cattle station owned by a British company, Vestey, which is in interest of the Lord Vestey, who we met in the song as well. And the match is now well and truly in the spinifex, as Hardy writes, and Lingyari now ignites it. When his demand for an immediate wage rise is denied by Wakehill management, he leads his people, the workers and their families, off the property. It's an act of huge historic significance, although no one really knows about it at the time. And the strike camp that they choose is on a riverbed near the house of Bill Jeffrey, who's a sympathetic employee of the welfare agency, a welfare agency hated by the Gurindji people and most Aboriginal people for its paternalism and its failure ever to do anything serious about their living conditions. Contrary to the song, it's actually quite a long time before they decide to move off to occupy the heart of their traditional land at Waddy Creek. For now, they're waiting, on strike against the wishes of the NAWU boss, Paddy Carroll. But Lingyari manages to hold out in the face of this official disapproval and also in the face of the good cop, bad cop tactics that Wakehill management try to employ, to desperate to get their stockmen back on strike to finish the muster. Hardy and other communists are also playing a leading role in coordinating supplies down from Darwin and perhaps most famously in arranging a speaking tour which heads south to garner political and financial support for the Gurindji. And this is, I think, one of the best bits of the book. And also is important for us in talking about the role of the white working class in the struggle. The tour is organised by Actors' Equity, the Actors' Union as it was back then, and it's led by a communist named Hal Alexander. He's initially agreed to fund the tour on the basis that a famous Aboriginal actor who's a member of the union, Robert Tadawali, will be the star attraction. Unfortunately, Tadawali is hospitalised with severe tuberculosis just before the tour, and it's ends up being Dexter Daniels, the union organiser or ex-union organiser, and another Gurindji stockman from Newcastle Waters, the first strike that broke out, whose name at this stage is Captain Major, although as he goes through the process he realises he's been using a name that's just been given to him by a white man, which is completely meaningless, and he reverts to his traditional Gurindji name, which is Lupna Gyari. And I think there's a really important lesson here about the role of the Communist Party, because for all its flaws, the existence of a left-wing party of a significant size has actually got influence within the working class is really crucial to the Gurindji struggle breaking out of isolation. Neither the Labor Party nor the NAWU leadership wanted to get behind the strike,
and in this case communist action was really decisive. And the tour is just one of many examples in this period of action taken by communist-led left-wing unions in support of Aboriginal rights. I want to read a little story which shows as well that it's not just the white-collar unions like maybe the actors or you might imagine the clerks or the teachers or whatever. It's a story that Lubna Gyari tells about a workplace visit in Sydney. "We went to a place called Garden Island," he says. "Speak to waterside workers. Wharfies, they call them fellas." Dexter said, "Good fellas, all them wharfies." "They gave him loudspeaker before. We talked through that, holding hand. Boys speak up loud. There was 500 here, but no women. Nobody asked me no question. Make proper speech, like Dexter. Dexter. Him good speaker, young Dexter. We spoke every day, Sunday five times, me and Dexter. Stan Baby, fella with the beard from Advancement League, there some days, or Frank, or Hal, or Wal Buckley, him engineer. Then we came back, carpenters meeting, where they build in big buildings, 400 there. When we finished the meeting, then want to ask questions, and one fella, all white fellas there, union men, he yell out, "All right, you union men, we don't want no questions. We've been hear what these men say, we help them. I say we put in dollar each, every week, every man. All right, you men, you put in dollar." And I said to him, "That's a good idea." And he said, "Yes, we put in dollar." And they did. So Daniels and Gyari returned north, not only with a lot more money, which is very important, but with important in political experience, speaking in front of large crowds, and a sense that there are white people in the south who actually want to help and would do so if given the opportunity. But they go back up, and already the parameters of the struggle are changing, as we heard in the song. Just before the tour, Hardy has encountered Pincher Mangwari, who's one of the strike leaders. And Mangwari tells him, "That Tom Fisher, the station manager, we want him to go away. We want the investing mob all go away from here. We Waypill, Aboriginal native people, been called Gurindji. We've been here long time before the investing mob. They put up buildings thinking they own this country. This is our country. All of this country been Gurindji country. Waypill been our country." And Hardy writes at this point, "I had not really expected, after three generations of white domination, that the Aborigines would still have a sense of owning the land." But Pincher continues, "That Bethy mob never teach Gurindji people to read. But now our children go to schoolhouse. Later on, they've been learn everything and know what to do. Then we've been want this ground. All belong and we Gurindji. Children's grow up proper bookwork. We wait for that, then no white men here." So in early 1967, the Gurindji would take the momentous decision to move from the strike camp that they set up in the riverbed to Wadi Creek, which is the central place of the Gurindji dream, where they believe that the dead look after the living. And their plan is to occupy this land until they're granted the right to do so on a permanent basis or even ownership of the land. Hardy is invited to attend and address the gathering at which the decision is confirmed, which shows the trust in which he's held. And the next day, he actually witnesses the entire group of 200 people gathering up all their possessions and embarking on a 12-mile walk on foot away from the place which has been their home and their prison for generations and into history. And they begin the hard work of establishing a permanent settlement from nothing, with no support from welfare, no support from the government. But they're so energised by this act that they've taken, taking their future into their own hands, that it all goes really well, the work. So then, with Hardy's help, they petition the Governor-General to be granted control of the traditional land, and they're asking for a fraction of the cattle station. The petition's denied, but Hardy ends the book full of hope, because the Wadi Creek settlement's going from strength to strength. And at this time as well, left-wing Labor MPs like Tom Uren are raising the claim in Parliament and starting to put the government a little bit on the back foot. There's also the referendum, which grants Aboriginal people the vote, and this has received almost universal support. The tide appears to be turning. And in particular, I think Hardy's time at Waypill has given him a real confidence that the Gurindji not only have the tenacity, but also the ingenuity, even in white man's term, white man's politics, to triumph in their struggle. And he delights in recounting the small acts of cunning and rebellion, things like Pincher's plan to transport mineral-rich rocks from miles and miles away to the Wadi Creek place so that they can take out a mining lease for a claim on the land, or Vincent Lingari's decision to bring in the one and only Gurindji Christian to act as the missionary Jesus man, so that when welfare says, "Hey, you don't have a Jesus man," they go, "Yeah, we've got our own Jesus man, it's right here." And most of all, Hardy's really confident that now that they've broken new ground and they've broken from this horrific path, that Lingari's words will ring true when he says, "Aboriginal people don't need no policeman, no jail, no boss. Everybody know what he got to do." And that's pretty much what happened. So the book, The Unlucky Australians, released in 1968, and it did play its intended role of galvanising white support for the Gurindji. Under growing pressure that year, the Minister in charge of Aboriginal Affairs, Wentworth, visits Wadi Creek, and he proposed to accept an Aboriginal settlement of a mere 8 square miles. And even this pathetic suggestion is rejected by the Cabinet out of hand. They suggest moving the Gurindji to a dry patch of land which Vesties don't use anyway. And Nugget Coombs, the famous Nugget, who is chair of the recently formed Council for Aboriginal Affairs, writes in his memoirs of his own frustration at the time, and I quote, he said, "Any concession, even one designed merely to give the Gurindji rebels the opportunity to prove their capacity for economic independence, was strongly opposed by the pastoralists. Cabinet feared that to provide land from an area already under lease would lead to a succession of similar claims, which would be the more embarrassing if any acknowledgement of traditional rights were implied." By the next year, 1969, it seems like a stalemate had been reached. The McMahon government ended up legislating for what they called general purpose leases, which required Aborigines to prove a long association with the land, which sounds familiar from today. An outrage of this actually sparked the foundation of the first Aboriginal tent embassy at Parliament House on the 26th of January 1972, Invasion Day. And in fact, not one of these general purpose leases had been granted by the time the Whitlam Labor government took power at the end of 1972. But things do change with the election of Whitlam. They instruct the Northern Territory Land Board to issue no more development leases on reserves which might impair Aboriginal rights. Mining exploration licences were also suspended pending an inquiry, and at long last, a small grant of land at Wadi Creek was made as a step towards a complete handover. Then, finally, the handback took place on the 16th of August of 1975, and this is the bit in the song about the tall man arriving with his lawyers and great ceremony. And Whitlam, the famous image, I don't have a copy of it, people might recall Whitlam pouring the handful of sand into Vincent Lingyari's hand. And that victory, which took 8 long years to achieve, as I said, is commemorated every year on the 16th of August. And it's interesting as a political point that while the land rights legislation was unpassed at the time of the Whitlam government's dismissal, the incoming Fraser government enacted pretty similar legislation as the Aboriginal Land Rights Act in 1976. And so it sort of shows that, you know, whilst now we're in a position where Labor and Liberal both have terrible, terrible positions on Indigenous politics, at the time, both Labor and Liberal could be dragged into something resembling a better position because there was so much protest from below, because the struggle had broken out of isolation and the tide was turning. So, I'm going to finish up. I hope I've inspired some of you to read the book. I'm not actually sure whether it's on sale. The Unlucky Australians at the, at the conference. It is. So please, for a lot of them, please get a copy. It's a really inspiring, fantastic read, and we'll teach you a lot. But I just want to draw out a couple of lessons quickly, which I think hopefully will spark a bit of discussion. Thanks. And the first is the most obvious, which is that white Australia really has given nothing to the Indigenous people of this land, except perhaps disease, grog, drugs, things like that. And what it's taken away, their land, their way of life, their children. In the 1920s, Wadjuk whites massacred a large number of Gurindji and almost wiped out the Walbiri tribes in the area. And the employment of the survivors really was more like slavery than what we would call a proper job. They weren't even allowed to leave the cattle station without the permission of management. And the thing to remember is, well, this isn't something that's happening in the distant past. Well, I was thinking about it, my parents were just a little bit younger than me when this was happening in the late 60s, and yet it seems like it should be something from another world. But people like the Gurindji fought their way out of this situation. They took a stand not just for piecemeal reform, a bit more money, but a completely new deal to win back their land. And by really shifting the goalposts, by changing the paradigm like that, they transformed the whole debate around Indigenous rights and Aboriginal land rights. So I think in hindsight, we can see the Gurindji walk off as a pretty similar kind of act to, say, Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus in America, Montgomery, Alabama, in 1955. This act was seen as sparking the entire civil rights movement in America. And I think that's important because obviously this struggle didn't take place in isolation. There was a whole lot of things going on at that time. People were inspired by the anti-colonial movements after the Second World War, civil rights in America, the movement against the Vietnam War. And the confidence at this time of the victory of one oppressed people was really flowing onto another, and you create this snowball effect where it seems like change really is possible, and hey, if we get going now, things can really happen. Even media organisations like The Australian, while denouncing the entire Gurindji struggle, the entire thing as a communist plot, still had to say things like this in their editorials. Quote, "We have only ourselves to blame if the vacuum we have left in Aboriginal welfare and education is filled by the communists." So they're not even pretending anymore that things are actually all right. Things have to change. Today, though, with the trade unions and the left so much weaker, and after decades without these strong social movements, I think, you know, it's clear that the Australian government is busily winding back the clock. 40 years ago, we had people like the Gurindji who fought for and won respect. They actually showed millions of non-Indigenous workers and students not only that Indigenous people had suffered, but they were fighting back and their struggles were worth supporting. But now, particularly the last 11 years, we've seen Howard really waging a war on all fronts against this legacy. We've had his promoting of pseudo-historians like Keith Windschuttle in their denial of stolen generations and Aboriginal genocide, the dismantling of ATSIC, the supporting of racist campaigns like the Australian's hysterical expose of sexual violence in Indigenous communities, and so on. And obviously this is far from the exclusive domain of the coalition. The Hawke government back in the 80s was notorious for reneging on pretty much every single land rights promise that it made in the lead up to the 1983 election, under pressure from mining and big pastoralists. Now, what do we see with Kevin Rudd? You know, Kevin Rudd's showing every sign of adopting exactly the Howard approach, so-called tough love, pushing Indigenous communities into private home ownership and making it harder for them to obtain financial support. He looks like he's set to discard the three mines policy on uranium mining and now high-level support, obviously, for the Australian nuclear industry. This is putting the issue of outback waste dumps back on the agenda. So I think in this context, and with so little progress being made and things often going backward, it's not surprising that we've seen these little violent outbursts of resistance. And for socialists, both Redfern and Palm Island are inspiring examples, we want to make this clear, inspiring examples of Indigenous people standing up and fighting back against murder at the hands of the police. And these could have been important turning points, but unfortunately too few people in the broader community and in the working class were willing to stand with them. The mainstream leadership pretty much lined up with the government in denouncing them. Now, we in Socialist Alternative, we took a stand with the people of Redfern and Palm Island, but at the moment, obviously, we're too small to make a serious difference. But I think that's where we want to end, and we'll be talking about this all weekend. If you do agree with us, if you agree that the whole business of Australian capitalism is opposed to the rights of Indigenous people, you know, from sheep and cattle, from mining wheat and cotton, to the destruction of the environment, from attacks on workers' rights, black and white, to the dismantling of welfare and the rewriting of history. If you're opposed to all these things and you want to do something about it, then I think you should be joining us today. There will, as I said, always be these turning points in history when people break through the system and even for a moment show that there's a new way of doing things. And I think the difference between Wave Hill and something like, you know, Redfern or Palm Island being in the next moment like that is the existence of organisations like Socialist Alternative having the kind of weight to be able to then go out into the working class and actually have an influence and garner some real support, and to support a new generation of Indigenous leadership that's going to have to rise up and be leading these struggles. So I want to end in a fairly predictable way, I suppose, 40 years on from the Gurindji strike, and say that, you know, today we can maybe take as our motto the Paul Kelly line, "From little things, big things grow." Cheers.